Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 2:36 p.m. and today is August 17th. And of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I thought that I would start off today by looking at this graphic from the IMF. It gives us the US dollar denominated debt issued by a whole host of different countries. Well, I think particularly since this is an 18-year history, or let's say a 17-year history since it goes up to 2017, that it gives us two important pieces of information. The first is that the trend has been expanding for an awfully long time already. I think that's certainly one case. The blue part is the onshore issuance. The pink part is the offshore issuance. Well, two points that really stand out. One is Brazil has got approximately $100 billion of debt that's denominated in a currency other than the Brazilian real. But China's expansion of offshore issuance has been epic since the beginning of 2013. That's something that I think many people are not particularly aware of. It's also part of the reason why the Chinese administration just in the last 6 weeks banned the issuance of foreign currency debt. We know what the reason why that expansion has occurred. It's because back in 2015, they started to lean on property developers. They started saying to them, you have got too much debt, there's going to be a property bubble, you're going to put the entire economy in danger. So they started weighing on the banks to stop lending to the domestic property market. But these are highly leveraged operations. If you cut off the source of funding entirely, then they'd crash. So what they tended to start doing was issuing bonds overseas and bringing in foreign investors. This is something that I have been talking about now for at least the last 2 years. It's the way to think about it is in terms of an insurance company. How does an insurance company mitigate its risk? Well, they start laying it off. They start to sell bits of the risk off to other investors. It's exactly the same thing that bookies do when they've got bets that are too large. And that's exactly what China had been doing until quite recently, that they were encouraging foreign investment in their economy, but most particularly in the property development side of the economy. And that is where all of that additional debt has come from, approximately $400 billion worth. Well, everyone is worried about Turkey. There has been an enormous amount of issuance over the course of its history, and the pace of that advance has been rising steadily, and the Turkish lira has been deteriorating steadily. But it's the size of that debt relative to the size of the economy is what has people worried. That doesn't mean that the size of China's debt is something that we shouldn't worry about. It's something, obviously, that anyone who's lent them money will be worrying about, particularly when we simply do not know what the default rate is. This is one of the great unknowns. It's a known unknown, but it's an unknown nonetheless for the Chinese economy. We just do not know how much debt they have that is going to, or excuse me, what the we don't know how much debt they have, but we also don't know what the natural default rate is for the market. So that's something that I think we are going to find out eventually. But that's what people are worried about right now. They're worried about Turkey and they're worried about China. Well, the Turkish lira has bounced pretty emphatically in here this week. And what that is beginning to suggest is that you've had a little bit of short covering coming in, and not least because Qatar has decided that they are going to contribute $15 billion to buying or to supporting the currency. But that's a bridging loan relative to the size of the outstanding debts. And I think the rather harsh reality is that Turkey has been going at growth at all costs for much of the last 15 years, and now they're coming towards the end of that cycle. There's going to have to be some fiscal consolidation. We haven't really seen what shape that's going to happen in. But the acceleration to 7 by the US dollar, or that acceleration lower by the Turkish lira, has obviously had some climactic activity that we saw back on Monday. But now we're in for some volatile ranging. There's, I think, a strong likelihood that that 7 area is going to be retested, and then the question will be whether it holds. If we look at this over the very long term, there is absolutely nothing on the chart that really says that the long history of devaluation of the lira is over, but that we have seen an interim low, and that now we're in for some additional ranging. One of the currencies that has really stuck out in here this week has been the Indian rupee. It had been ranging above its lows for much of the last while. Now, if we look at that the other way around, then I think we can get a better idea of exactly what's going on. And when we look at that, we can see that it did have base formation characteristics between 2013 and approximately the end of 2017, and then it just started to turn downwards. Now it's at new reaction lows. Well, we can conclude from this chart that there have been periods when the rupee has been firm, but that the downtrend is still in place. That it really did look like it was breaking the downtrend back in 2017, and now that has failed. So we are in now a period of which is a more difficult period generally for international investors. So that, I think, is that any gains that are achieved by the stock market are going to be measured against the loss that's going to be taken on the currency markets. So when we look at, for example, the a UK fund or a US fund, then they're not performing like the stock market is in nominal terms. But nonetheless, what we have seen is that this was an important week for the JP Morgan India Trust. It pulled back very sharply on Wednesday when we had the breakdown by the rupee, but it has bounced. And part of the reason for that is because the stock market is doing quite well. And I think something that's important to highlight that doesn't really get enough of airing, but you don't buy countries, you buy stocks. And by buying the Nifty, you are owning shares. And there is an important bull market hypothesis that needs to be aired more clearly with regard to India, and it is that they're on the cusp of a digital revolution. And India today is probably where China was 6 or 7 years ago. They've really only just got to grips with the release of 4G. Everyone is increasingly getting smartphones. They have full biometric data for everyone in the country, and everyone now has a digital bank account. So the stage really is set for a digital revolution where online shopping becomes a really big deal. And Reliance Industries is very well placed to take advantage of that. But I think it's also worth highlighting that online shopping has become so de rigueur in most economies that the epic size of the moves is in many respects justified by the decline in influence of brick and mortar. Now, we're not going to see the complete demise of the brick and mortar sector, but and neither is it that the online sector is going to be completely overwhelming, but we're going to get back to some sort of mix where online does more physical and physical does more online. Amazon is really quite overextended relative to its trend mean, and it is due some consolidation. We know that every time that it has become overextended in the past, it has pulled back, and we're getting increasingly close to the next one of those episodes. Apple has continued to expand. I think that it is very noteworthy that Apple has in many respects adopted a subscription business model, that we may have reached a point where we have peak iPhone, but that does not mean we're at peak subscription revenue. That Amazon is now starting to get in on starting to prepare to get in on the music selling market, and will challenge Apple and Spotify. But when we look at the trend here that we have for Amazon, I think it is not an exaggeration to say that it is beginning to accelerate. And that is something that's worth considering. That when we look at the long-term trend for the S&P or the Nasdaq 100, well, the Nasdaq bottomed in 2008 in the region of its 2002 lows, and then has been trending higher for until about 2016. But then in 2016, the pace of the advance picked up, and it really did extraordinarily well until the beginning of this year and had a somewhat larger pullback, and then very quickly broke higher once more. Well, when we think about what exactly is going on in the U.S. market, I think, and Wall Street really is the leader in terms of performance that we've had for a couple of different reasons. The first is that they were the most aggressive in adopting quantitative easing first. So they also forced their banking sector to absorb the losses, and that was a massive socialization of private sector debt. And the way it was paid for was by crippling the ability of savers to make a yield. So US 2-year yields got down to a low back in 2011 in the region of 18 basis points. Well, if you're a pension fund and you've got your cash rolling over at less than 20 basis points for any period of time, well, it means that the rest of the portfolio has got to be yielding more. And that is why we have seen so many European banks and pension funds, and indeed US pension funds, getting into places like Turkey or lending money to highly leveraged property developers in China, because they're chasing yield. But what it has also created is this massive amount of demand for higher yielding bonds. And that means then that covenants tend to get impaired. That if you're an issuer and you know that the people buying the bonds are desperate for the yield, well, you can afford to then insist that they don't get the kinds of covenants that they might have wanted before. What I find particularly interesting about this chart is that most of the news stories that we see are focusing on the fact that covenant-lite loans in the USA overtook the issuance that we saw back in 2007, in 2012, and now they are more than double what they were at the peak in 2006 and 7. So that's certainly one big takeaway, but I think a much bigger takeaway is the influence that the ECB's quantitative easing program has had on covenant-lite issuance in the Eurozone. It really started to take off in 2012 and 2013 from zero in 2011. And what happened in 2013 and 2014? Well, we know what happened. It was the ECB's quantitative easing program. And when we look at that, and just simply look at the longer-term chart, after the contraction we saw in between 2012 and 2014 in terms of the ECB's balance sheet, then it engaged in its big quantitative easing program, which started in the middle of 2014 and is only now starting to come to an end. So that has the, and I think it's also worth pointing out that Europe generally is much more influenced by the bond market than the equity market. European investors tend to be much more comfortable buying debt, and you don't have as liquid an equity market in Europe as you do elsewhere. So those people that were hungry for yield have obviously then been running around looking for where they can get the yields they need, and they have also been buying these covenant-lite loans. Well, the ECB's quantitative easing program is coming to an end because they're going to stop making purchases next month. So that is contributing to the size of the central bank balance sheets contracting. And when I think about the consistency of this trend over the course of at least the last 16 years, this is the biggest contraction we've seen. If the peak, which was back at the beginning of this year, was approximately 20 point, and I can, let me just zoom in. It's much easier to see the peaks when we zoom in. The peak was at 20.8 trillion and we're currently at 19.75. So we have had a 1.1 trillion contraction in the size of global central bank balance sheets. Well, we know that the ECBs are still expanding. The Federal Reserve has replaced its monetary policy stimulus with fiscal policy stimulus. And that is one of the primary reasons why we continue to see that we have a stimulative effect on asset prices in the USA. Well, eventually that is going to end. And when that eventually does end, it's going to represent a further contraction. In the Mahjong circle that Mrs. Tracy is a part of, one of the ladies was talking about the fact that she put her house, a friend of hers put her house up for $4.5 million for sale and eventually had to take $2.5 million. Well, that's an awfully big contraction in the higher end of the market. Part of the reason for that is because of the change to the tax code that came in with the Trump tax cuts at the beginning of this year. I think what a lot of international investors don't really pay attention to is that these tax cuts don't really come into effect until people start paying their 2018 taxes in the first quarter of 2019. When we look at and something that I've seen, and I think it's not just anecdotal, but the number of Rolls Royces and Bentleys on the road around where I live has been multiplying. That I think when I first moved to Los Angeles about 3 years ago, they were quite rare. Whereas I see one at least every day, if not every other day now. And these are all brand new cars. When we also look at the shares of a company like Ruth Chris, this is a share that has been trending higher now for a considerable period. And it's a reasonably upscale restaurant experience. Well, what that also suggests is that the pace of this advance has been picking up since the end of 2017, and it probably suggests that people are taking their tax cut money and spending it in bars and restaurants. And if we look at another restaurant group, I think we're going to have a similar story. So this suggests to me that people are spending the money. And there was also news stories approximately a year ago about the way that investment banks were extending credit to their highest net worth individuals was that they were lending money for yachts and boats and expensive cars and real estate against their stock portfolios. And the stock portfolios have continued to expand, so therefore that has not been a problem. But when we do get a recession, then those are the kinds of debt instruments that really do start to have an influence. We also know that the way that quantitative easing has entered the market has been via buybacks. That originally, companies started using the much lower yields as a way of refinancing old debt so that they could borrow at really attractive levels and retire their older and more expensive debt. Then they started borrowing to pay dividends and to pay for buybacks. And the reduction in the supply of shares has been a stimulative effect and has helped to inflate asset prices, at least in the stock market. Then you also had dividend growth, which is a main one of the primary contributors to total return in the stock market. Then, before we had the tax cuts, companies like Apple and the big technology companies with substantial cash piles overseas that they wanted to repatriate but couldn't do so because of the higher taxes were simply issuing foreign currency debt. And then, because debt is a liability rather than an asset on the balance sheet, then it was repatriated. The proceeds from the debt were repatriated and were not taxed. And that's one of the additional methods where quantitative easing was used as a way of inflating stock prices. Well, we also know that the higher the price goes, the more money that has to be used to have the same influence in terms of the buybacks. Well, the Buyback Achievers ETF, interestingly, has a very similar pattern to the Dow Jones. And the Dow Jones Industrials is a rather interesting index from a number of perspectives because it's obviously its constituents are some of the largest industrial companies, but it did accelerate to get up to the peak that we saw at the beginning of January. And it has held to the progression of higher reaction lows. It has had a lengthier pullback. We are now 7 months into this medium-term correction for the Dow Jones. This has been the index that had the clearest evidence of acceleration and therefore had the greatest risk of a lengthier period of consolidation. The Russell 2000 was among the first to break higher. That is still holding its advance and it is firming within its range. So this still looks like a reasonably consistent uptrend. And the pullback that we saw in February looked like a medium-term correction for the leading markets. And a medium-term correction is a pullback of anything from 6 months to 2 years. And that's just about what we've had, about 7 months so far. So we've already seen some of these indices breaking higher. And now the big question is whether now we're going to see acceleration higher because the economy is doing well and the US, because it has transitioned from monetary policy to fiscal policy stimulus, it encourages additional foreign investment. And part of the reason for that is the relative strength of the dollar. And the dollar remains on a recovery trajectory. Now, it was somewhat weaker in here today because there is at least some speculation that there is going to be a thawing of relations between the Trump administration and China. And there is the possibility that we're coming towards the end of the, or at least we're coming to a detente in terms of the trade wars. Personally, I think that this is going to be just an interlude in terms of the dollar's recovery. But the dollar is overbought in the short term, and particularly against some of those emerging markets. So it does have room in which to consolidate. But that as long as the USA is raising interest rates and is still one of the highest growth markets in the developed world, then that is likely to continue to represent a bullish factor. Well, it's also worth keeping an eye on what's going on with Europe because Europe has exposure both to Turkey and to China. And the euro is at, well, it was distributing below the trend mean and then it broke downwards last week. It was a little bit steadier in here this week, but it has a lot of work to do in order to really demonstrate that we're in a demand-dominated environment. Well, when we look at what's going on in the gold market, it has been heavily influenced by what's been going on in the dollar. And it accelerated lower earlier this week, and we've begun to see the first evidence of at least some steadying within the context of this really rather consistent downtrend. There was an acceleration lower over the 4 of the last 5 sessions. It closed off its low yesterday, but it really does need to break the progression of lower rally highs to really demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. This has been a very consistent decline since April, but most importantly, I think the fact is that when we look at it over that longer-term basis, It did have a rounding characteristic, and it has now broken that rounding characteristic. Now, that suggests that we're in for a more volatile trading environment, that the process of support building could take longer before it can eventually break higher. And I think, therefore, this is a more volatile environment. But it's also, I think, evident that gold is $90 overextended relative to the trend mean at the present time. It was $100 earlier on yesterday. So it does have scope here for a rally. And when we look at a major gold miner like Goldcorp, then and I put up the US listing. Well, the clear influence here is that it has come all the way back down to the lows that we saw at the beginning of 2016 and back in 2004. So there is a lot of bad news has been priced into the share. And gold prices are still above $1,000. So the vast majority of these gold miners are in a position where they can make money from producing gold, even at these reduced levels. But it's an under-owned asset class generally. And gold tends to do best when inflation is running ahead of the willingness of central banks to really raise interest rates, whereas we just don't have that condition right now. And until we have that condition, then I think gold is going to be somewhat more volatile. But certainly it is oversold in the short term, and it does have capacity for a bounce in here right now. When we look at the crude oil market, it's right back in the region of the trend mean. If we think about really long-term themes, then we can think about the debt markets, and debt is certainly a big issue, and not least as the US market starts to more aggressively raise interest rates, not least because of the quantity of debt that's outstanding and the reliance and the distorting effect that quantitative easing has had on the debt markets. That is a significant challenge, and it's one of the reasons that I continue to look at high yield spreads. And I will come back to the oil market in a moment, but one of the reasons that I look so closely at high yield spreads is one, because they have been so inert for so long, but they also tend to lead the stock market in terms of identifying when credit conditions start to tighten. And credit conditions have not yet started to tighten in the high yield market. So we know that there are problems and that there are challenges out there in terms of the quantity of debt that's outstanding and the ease with which highly leveraged companies have been able to take out that debt. I've often said that I think that companies like Tesla and Netflix are the canaries in the coal mine for the credit markets. Tesla is a CCC rated credit, and it was down heavily in here this week again. We can look at the internal dynamics of this range, and we had a very clear upward dynamic from the $300 area, and now we have an equally emphatic downward dynamic in here this week. There is the realistic possibility that Elon Musk is going to get into trouble for making statements that were deemed to potentially manipulating the markets. And that is going to throw some focus onto the rather excessive debt that is outstanding in the company. Now, Netflix is at a point where it has got to where anyone who wants it has probably already got it. Now, it's the big question is whether it is going to find support in the region of the trend mean. This is not falling because of missteps by its CEO or because of tweets. It's because the incremental cost of client acquisition is rising rather alarmingly, and they are spending massive amounts of money on programming, and that is not being covered by subscription revenue. So now the big question is whether it is going to find support, and it did most definitely accelerate. It is still the best performing share on the Nasdaq this year, and that is despite the fact that it is down from a peak of 423 to 316 over the last 7 or 8 weeks. So these are highly indebted companies that really benefited from the very low interest rate environment. And while spreads have not yet started to widen for the high yield market generally, the fact that you have these kinds of companies that are increasingly developing topping characteristics, that's not good news for the high yield market. I think then if we're going to round out the review of credit, we do need to look at the yield curve spread. And the yield curve spread is at 25 basis points, so it has improved somewhat, or excuse me, expanded somewhat in here this week. It's up about 1 basis point. It is not inverted, and it's not until it is inverted that we will eventually have a lead indicator for the next recession. So we know that this, considering everything that we've discussed so far, that we're in a mature stage of this market cycle. The CAPE, or the cyclically adjusted PE developed by Shiller, also tells us that valuations are at their highest level ever historically. So that also is telling us that we are not early in this cycle. But the performance of Wall Street also tells us that it's not over. And that holds out the prospect that either we're going to have one of three trend-ending characteristics. Tops don't just occur, that all tops share one of three trend-ending characteristics. Well, it could accelerate, that's the first one. And we've definitely got some evidence of acceleration starting to come through in those FANG shares. Certainly, Facebook has had a self-inflicted wound, and it was down in a rather dynamic way in here today. But Google, Amazon, and Apple have still been are still pushing on to new high ground. Then, a type two reaction would be the massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and or we get some a loss of momentum which precedes the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. Well, we've had a massive reaction against the prevailing trend in Facebook, but not in any of the other primary markets. So when we look at the pullbacks that we saw in January, those were massive reactions, and those have held up some markets for longer than others. Well, as long as indices are trading above their respective trend means, then I think people are not going to be overly concerned. But if we then see that the lows are taken out and that indices are ranging below their respective trend means and then breaking down, well, then we're talking about a completed type 2 top. And then, of course, you have the type 3 top, which would be ranging time and size. And these are big volatile patterns, and they never start off as type 3s, that they can start off by either a massive reaction against the trend or an acceleration or lengthier ranging, but that they tend to be big and volatile and difficult to work with. And we just don't have evidence of those just yet. If we're going to look at anywhere that has got evidence of a type 3 top, well, it would have to be in Europe. That the Europe Stoxx 600 has been ranging below the 400 level for 18 years, and as long as and over the last 18 months, it has been ranging in a volatile manner again below that level. Well, considering the fact that the euro has been weak and the challenges, well, the euro has been weak. The ECB is about to end its quantitative easing program, and then you have the challenges from the Italian banking sector, but not just the Italian banking sector. The European banking sector is weak and is heavily exposed to Turkey. Then all of these factors are influencing the performance of European shares, and this does not look like a particularly bullish environment. When we look at what is going on out there in the wider world, there are, I think, three important bullish characteristics. One is that we have had this revolution in energy, and the oil market is back in the region of the trend mean, and the USA has gone from being the biggest importer to being an important swing exporter. And that is a massive game changer for the global energy markets. It really does mean that the profitability of the US shale sector is going to have a big influence over the lengthy medium term on the price of oil. And it is going to become progressively more difficult for prices to be sustained above $80 as long as the USA is producing, because so much of additional supply becomes economic above those levels. So that also helps to explain why the pace of oil's advance has moderated over the course of the last while. If the upward bias is to be given the benefit of the doubt, then it's going to bounce in here over the next couple of weeks. Then copper is often referred to as Dr. Copper, and that is because of the influence that copper has on the global economy. But it's most particularly influenced by what's going on in China. And this breakdown from this range is a type 2 top. When we look at the loss of momentum, the failed upside breaks, and then the massive reaction against the prevailing trend, this is a type 2 top when we look at the copper price, and it's not a bullish pattern. Quite often, after a massive reaction, you get a period of ranging below the peak. It now suggests that $3 is going to be an area of resistance rather than support for copper over the next lengthy or the next number of months. And that's when we look at it in the short term, it is there is the potential for a bounce to come through, but there has been some significant technical deterioration. Then I think soybeans really do stand out. When we look at this chart, it has come all the way back down to the lows that we saw in 2008 and 2016, and we're starting to see the first evidence of support starting to come through. Soybeans is a staple in terms of the Chinese diet, so the refusal to import has been an issue, but they've had a terrible time in terms of the harvest in China this year, where there has been first a drought and then a flood, and that has impacted yields in China. So that I think is part of the reason why they're coming back to the table and are willing to negotiate once more, because China cannot have rapid agricultural price inflation when they have to feed 1.3 billion people, and the national priority is to maintain social cohesion. So, therefore, they need to import soybeans, and that should help to act as a support for the market. What this says to me is that governance really is everything, and we have concentrated mostly in terms of media coverage over the last week on the influence that the lack of improving standards of governance have had on various markets. China and Turkey and Argentina and Venezuela are very clear examples of where an absence of improving standards of governance have had a clearly deleterious effect. We do have improving standards of governance in places like India, and Indonesia is going to be having an election, which will be a rerun of the last election in the next while. And the Indonesian rupiah is also one of those currencies that has been weakening, and not least because Widodo is probably going to try and buy himself the election. That is also what Modi is going to do in India, and that is having a deleterious effect on their currencies in the short term. They'll probably get more, I think, attuned to the fiscal liabilities they have created when they've won their respective elections, or if they win their respective elections. But the downward pressure on their currencies is it's probably a short to medium term impact. Well, these types of countries they do tend to be volatile, and the Jakarta Composite is sustaining its move below the trend mean, and it really does need to bounce. Well, when we look at it over the medium term, these are high population countries with large young populations, and they are going to be where consumer demand is going to appear over the course of the next 20 years. Then, of course, you have Africa, which is coming off of a very low base in terms of its governance, but it is where the vast majority of population growth is going to occur over the next 20 years. And that is a very important bullish factor over the long term. So then we have technological innovation, and that is most acute in the energy sector, but it's also in the healthcare sector, that we have the confluence of the incredible pace of innovation in genetic sequencing and in genetic editing via CRISPR. So that's having an important factor in terms of driving the pace of innovation in cancer treatment. And the cancer immunotherapy ETF does not really do justice to the performance of the smaller cap shares within it. So, for example, when we look at some of the smaller companies, they're getting bought out by the bigger companies. Then those that are still in independent have rallied really rather spectacularly over the course of the last couple of years. There are certainly some have had really quite substantial pullbacks after rather meteoric rises, but perhaps the most important thing is that they're holding the breakouts, and the pace of innovation is improving all the time. So we are at a point where I think the realization that has bypassed a lot of analysts is that treating cancer is one of the biggest drags on the global economy that there is, and that is a significant factor that could help to drive productivity if we can help to ameliorate that substantial cost on the global economy. Then I think another important point about technology is that it tends to go global. And when we look at the semiconductors sector, it has lost momentum over the course of the last year. There are two important points. One is that its growth was really driven by the incredible pace of the advance on NVIDIA. And NVIDIA made a very important statement yesterday, and it was that they don't anticipate having any additional revenue coming from cryptocurrency mining. And there was also a new story in here this week talking about Bitmain, which is the largest miner and producer of chips for mining, I'm going to have to plug in this computer pretty soon. But when we look at the fact that Bitmain is looking at an IPO and Nvidia is at a point where it is no longer going to be getting money from the cryptocurrency market, well, that's been one of the primary growth markets for the chip sector, most particularly graphics. And this loss of momentum on Nvidia does have type 2 topping characteristics. If we get a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, it's over. And that is after a rally from $25 to $250 over the course of the last 2.5 years. Then you have and it was a statistic I saw I can't remember where this week, and it was that China spends more money on importing chips than it does oil. Well, we know therefore that China is going to be embarking on developing its own chip manufacturing sector as a matter of domestic economic urgency. Most particularly as this threat of trade wars is unlikely to dissipate anytime soon. So China has got clear ambitions to be a global power. It's doing whatever it can to achieve those goals, and those goals will not be achieved over a short time frame. It's a long-term time frame. One of the most important points, because we simply just do not have the improving standards of governance, it means that the performance of the stock market and the is not a national priority for a totalitarian regime, and that they don't rely on the performance of the stock market for their personal wealth, and it continues to trend lower. And this also helps to highlight that with the quantity of external debt, with the downward pressure that is coming onto the property market, then the massive reaction we've seen in copper, that China is the epicenter of risk, and it is such a it is so much bigger a risk than Turkey is. This is, I think, where the real black swan is in terms of the global economy, because it really doesn't appear to be in the lexicon of most investors that China could have a really big problem. And I think if I was worrying about anything, it's not so much Turkey but China. My faith in the continued advance of the global consumer is unabashed. I think that as long as we have improving standards of governance in high population areas with young populations, then that is still a very clear trend. The pace of technological innovation is going to persist, and the revolution in the energy market is going to continue to benefit energy producers, and most particularly the USA. But it's going to require a substantial innovation in battery technology or fusion, or indeed building a lot more nuclear reactors for big consumers like China to really gain the wherewithal to become truly global powers. So China dreams of a bipolar world, or indeed of becoming the global hegemon. And I think that that is unrealizable, and that it is these totalitarian regimes look strongest right before they look weakest. So I really don't think that China is going to achieve the kinds of goals that it has set for itself, that it has gone an awfully long time without a bear market, and that the performance of assets there today is not encouraging. And until we see substantial action of a corrective or corrective action, and most particularly loosening up credit, then the likelihood is that we are going to have more defaults, and that the stock market is reflecting that. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.